Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and we are once again lucky to be broadcasting from Milan, Italy at the Expo, the World Expo, and we are at the James Beard Restaurant, J Bar, in downtown Milan, across from the Duomo and above the Galleria. And today, we have people who've come a very far way. Kirsten and Mandy Dixon are from South Central Alaska, and talk about pioneers. They have been, I've known Kirsten for at least 21 years, and I know that it's because my daughter's 21, and I think she was a year or something when we met up in Cornell. But they have an extraordinary story, because Kirsten and her husband started the Wild Adventure Company, right? And they own their whole family. They have two daughters, Carly and Mandy, and they own and operate the Winter Lake Lodge, Tutka Bay Lodge, the cooking school at Tutka Bay, a home goods boutique, Rustic Wild, you have to tell us what that is, La Balin Cafe, having started the French Culinary Institute, I think that means whale, right, Balin, and all of that in South Central Alaska. I remember when I first met you, Kirsten, you had to fly into your resort. Is that still the case?
That's right. Well, in those days, Dorothy, we actually had a different lodge that we've sold since then, but we still do fly into Winter Lake Lodge. So our company is called Within the Wild, and that's just an umbrella name for all our little projects that we get into. And many things many of our adventures have come about just through passion and desire. My little cooking school is not like your cooking school. it's on an old crabbing boat, and moored on shore. We have no running water. We have no ovens, but we have a lot to share with our guests who come and spend the day with us at Tutka Bay Lodge.
Wow. So we're going to get into it. As I said, I've known Kirsten for 21, 22 years, but I think it's incredibly wonderful because we have her daughter, Mandy, with us, who is a trained chef. Kirsten, you trained at the Cordon Bleu in Paris, but Mandy, you went to Cordon Bleu in Pasadena and then the CIA and worked for Thomas Keller as a pastry chef, and now you've joined your mother. This is such an incredible interview to have two women chefs. Unbelievable. You're the pioneering women chefs if we ever had them, and it's going to be very, very exciting. So welcome to both of you. Welcome, Mandy.
Thank you very much.
So, first thing, Kirsten, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story and how you became a chef, and then we'll get into Mandy and why she's followed in your footsteps.
Well, I was working as a nurse in an intensive care unit in Anchorage, in Alaska, and I went there because I had a scholarship with the Public Health Service, so they sent me there. And I met my husband, Carl, who was just getting ready to get out of his practice. He was an audiologist. He had already had the idea to move somewhere further away from Anchorage, further away from people, in a more wild life. And when we married, about a year after we married, we really decided to change our lives. We sold everything we owned. We flew to a piece of property that was north and west of Anchorage, and we just began our lives, and we've never looked back. We
How many years ago was that?
That was 33 years ago. And to some degree, you know, we always knew we could go back to the medical profession if we needed to. I mean, we were very young, younger then, and we had that option, but we have never looked back. We've raised our two daughters in the backcountry. They were homeschooled with us. Then they went away for college, and both girls came back. I've had moments of time when I've gone into the world, certainly at moments like when I met you, and I love to learn, and I love to experience new places. But then very, you know, often we are more insulated in our lives in Alaska, and we're perfectly happy there. We're quite content in our lives lived very close to nature.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in California, in Northern California, in the Bay Area, Marin County. My father worked for the State Department, so we traveled around quite a bit to different locations when I was a young girl. I went from California to Syracuse University for nursing school. I really wanted to come back east and had never lived back east, and New York City was a little bit too big for my parents to let me live there. So Syracuse was a good choice. And then I moved to Anchorage. I thought, you know, at the time I would probably be the kind of nurse that would travel the world and spend a lot of time in Africa, and I never left Alaska.
Wow, this is mind-blowing. So you're from a very cosmopolitan place, Marin County. You traveled the world with the State Department and then in New York and for university. What was your thought going to Anchorage? I mean, I think most of us have never been there. I've been to Juneau. That's, you know, I've done the lower part of the state, but that's very different. So were you back to nature? I don't want to see people. I mean, were you rejecting something or were you going to something?
I think, you know, I was a little bit along for the ride with my husband. You know, I would certainly have never perhaps been brave enough to seek that kind of lifestyle by myself, and even now I think it would be very hard for me to live in the backcountry without my husband, who carries a heavy load in terms of literally building houses for us. He's built all my kitchens. He's
dug wells for water.
Yeah, we've dug our own wells for water. He cuts our firewood in the winter, along with, you know, some help these days. And but we live very simply. We live really where we live now at Winter Lake Lodge. It's 200 miles to the nearest road, and so
200 miles to the nearest road. How do you get to the road?
We fly in airplanes of various size. On either a ski plane or float plane. Ski plane in the winter, floats in the summer. All our supplies are brought in by airplane. All our guests fly in by airplane.
So you have no neighbors?
We have no neighbors, but we're...
How many people live in your family there?
Technically, we're a population of two on the map, my husband and I. But my daughter, Mandy, for example, why don't you tell us what you do, Mandy?
Well, okay, we're going to... So, nope, that's okay. So, Mandy, tell me, what was it like growing up in that atmosphere? We never got to how you started cooking, but we'll come back.
Yeah,
you're not done. So, what was it like growing up in that? Is that all you knew? Is Winter Lake Lodge?
Pretty much. I mean, I was born and raised at home, and so I was born at our house in Anchorage at the time. And the day after I was born, I was flown out into the wilderness and grew up there and was homeschooled there with my sister. So it was all I knew.
There were no other kids.
No other kids when I was growing up, and but lots of people coming to work for my parents at the lodge, and lots of incredible chefs coming from all over the world, coming to this little cabin in the woods to cook for our guests. And so I grew up living above the kitchen of the lodge, literally above the kitchen. And so I would come down every day and help the chefs cook. And that's kind of where that's where my passion for cooking really began.
I can imagine. Did you have TV?
No.
I didn't think so. I mean, if you're going to go back country. So did you play with bears? I mean, I'm just having all these wild. I know you've seen them. I've seen them in Connecticut.
Yes, bears are everywhere. Yeah. But we were homeschooled, so a lot of our day would be with our teacher, our nanny and teacher. But it would be a lot of outdoor play, a lot of fishing and driving jet boats and gardening and a lot of cooking.
So you lived close to the land in the season. Yeah, and as my daughter says, I'm a big gardener. My mother doesn't think in terms of four seasons. She thinks week to week, day to day, because the earth changes like that. I bet what you've seen is, the way you feel about it. So tell me, how cold does it get? How hot does it get? And how bad are the flies and mosquitoes? That's what I always hear about Alaska.
Well, they're not too bad, and the weather has been changing recently, but we've had about 40 below Fahrenheit has been our coldest that we've probably gone through where we live recently. And last summer was, I think, our hottest on record, and we were up into the 90s, I think, at one point Fahrenheit. So it gets quite hot in the summer and cold in the winter.
So I can understand 90s. I can't understand 40 below Fahrenheit. So what is that like? Can you even go outside?
Yes. I think once you get past 20 below, it's all the same. It feels kind of all the same. But you prepare and you bundle up and dress for the elements, and it's just fine.
I know a German woman once told me there's no such thing as bad weather. There's only badly dressing for weather.
Exactly. That's right.
Except 90 degrees might be a little hard. So growing up with, what are your first food memories?
Salmon, I would say. I grew up on a cabin on a fishing river, a very beautiful and well-known salmon fishing river. So salmon is definitely one of my first cooking and eating memories. Lots of vegetables. We had a huge garden in our front yard that had beets and carrots and varieties of carrots. Carrots grow great in Alaska, and they're very sweet from all the sunshine that we get. Lots of potatoes and hearty root vegetables.
How long is your growing season?
It's about 90 days, I believe.
90 to 100, yeah.
Yeah.
That's because
it's pretty short.
Yeah, that is pretty short.
But we do preserve everything in the fall. It's kind of, a tradition, and a certain time of year comes around, we start harvesting everything and put it away, whether that's drying or canning or, preserving.
So what was your feeling when you kind of went down below the lower 48, as they say? How old were you when you first went there, and what drew you back to Alaska?
Well, I did want to learn more. At that time, there was no culinary school in Alaska, I believe. And so I found a really nice school in Pasadena, Le Cordon Bleu School, and it was close to Alaska, kind of. And so I was 17 when I graduated from high school, and I got a car and I drove down to LA. So it was a little bit of a shock to get on the I-5 highway and go down to Pasadena.
At 17? Mom, boy, your parents wouldn't let you go to New York to a school at 17. So tell me, I know in Juneau there's no road, and you said there's 200 miles by plane to the. So did you buy a car in Anchorage or something?
Yes. So I flew, to Anchorage, and then drove from Anchorage down to Los Angeles, and then I went to school there and learned some basics, and I got an internship at Chardonnay in San Francisco.
Tracy Desjardins, she's been here cooking and the expo, yeah.
So I did my internship there, and I really enjoyed the area. And
what was the biggest shock to you you know, of living in a city like in LA. I mean, you went from the frying pan to the fire.
Well, Pasadena wasn't so bad because it was kind of on the outsides of LA. But moving, driving up to San Francisco was really a shock for me. Living in such an urban area, it was really intense. I'd never seen anything like that before at the time. And I really enjoyed the culture of the city and the people and the restaurants and everything. But that's, I think, why I left after about a year of living there, was really just because it wasn't me to live in such an urban environment. And I did find Napa and explored Napa while I was in there in San Francisco, and really thought it kind of reminded me of Alaska a little bit, and how it was kind of, you know, out in the valley, and decided.
And so you were at the CIA and then Per Se? No, not Per Se. French Laundry, was it?
Well, I went to, I decided I wanted to learn more about baking and pastry specifically. So I went to a program there at the CIA for baking and pastry. And while I was there, I started working at Bouchon for a while. And while I was at Bouchon, they were just about to open this new restaurant called Ad Hoc. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, do you want to come over and help us over there? And so I moved over to Ad Hoc, and I worked there about a month, recipes and just kind of fell into the position of a pastry chef at Ad Hoc. You know, I was
next. You have to be very, very good, because they don't just do that. You have to be incredibly talented. You must be so proud, Kirsten.
And it was a great company to work for, you know, incredible people. And Thomas Keller is in the kitchen often, you know, overseeing everything. And they would take us to the French Laundry for training and just kind of keep us all communicating, his entire company, you know, communicating and sharing and learning from each other.
So what drew you back to Alaska?
I think it was really realizing how special Alaska is. When growing up as a teenager, you know, me and my friends, we kind of all said, you know, we're leaving Alaska. This, you know, there's nobody here. There's nothing to do. But once I was living outside of Alaska, I realized how incredible it is to work in these great restaurants. But I really missed Alaska and my family's business. And I thought, what a great opportunity to take what I've learned from these incredible chefs and bring it back, you know, to our family business.
So what was one ingredient in the lower 48 that you experienced that you thought, oh my God, I wish we had this in Alaska? And then what did you miss about Alaska when you were in the lower 48?
I think, I mean, there's so many things, you know, from the citrus and produce in California, you know, working in Napa Valley, there's just incredible ingredients that we could never get at our small cabin in the remote wilderness. And tomatoes. I mean, everything, almond paste or whatever it would be. I was often surprised at ingredients walking in the door. And things that I missed from home. Some of the wild berries are really unique to Alaska, in salmon, or, you know, to that latitude.
Like what?
Like salmon berries.
What are salmon berries?
Pick often. They're similar to a raspberry. They're slightly lighter in color and larger.
I am coming. Okay. You know what? I always said it, but now I'm of the age I can like take it easier and I'll have a little more time. Because you need a little time to get there, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, just a lot of traditional foods that my family eats, like a Russian salmon pie, which we're actually offering tonight as one of our appetizers. It's kind of something that's often served in our home, and living away for a couple years, you know, you kind of crave those kinds of things.
Yeah, wow. So we're going to take a little break here and we'll be right back.
If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious,
the planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today my guests are Kirsten and Mandy Dixon from South Central Alaska, and they have the Wild Adventure Company. And
Within the Wild.
Yes, and Winter Lake Lodge is their, you know, best-known property. And we were just talking with Mandy, who was homeschooled and grew up in the wild, 200 miles from the nearest road. So, Kirsten, we didn't get into how, were you forced to cook or something if you're going to open a lodge? Or did you always have a love of food? Were you always a good cook? What got you into?
I always enjoyed cooking, even through in childhood and when I was going to nursing school. And I think many of us who are wrapped in this culinary world, we know we can know sooner leave it than I mean, it's just wrapped into our DNA. Or, you know, we have to cook and we have to share food with others, or we have to write about food. It's just part of who we are. So I always loved to cook, and it wasn't really that I did have to cook for guests coming to our lodge in the beginning. I had no idea what I was doing in those days. Remember, there was no internet, and even I think, you know, in the early 80s and late 70s, you know, cookbooks weren't what they are today. And so it was a challenge for me. I was very lucky in that many of our guests were European, and many of them were restaurateurs, because they could bring salmon back to their home and serve it in the restaurant, and particularly in German-speaking Europe. So we had a lot of chefs staying with us, particularly European chefs, and I would learn from them. And
how many does your lodge hold? How many people would be there?
Yeah, about 15 to 20 people at max. So it's quite small, very small. I met a couple who, I mean, I didn't meet them. They came and stayed at our lodge every summer for many, many years. They'd come and stay the whole month of June, go back to Paris in July, come back again for the whole month of August. And they knew that I loved to cook, and they really became my benefactors. They invited me to Paris, and I stayed with them. They facilitated my attendance at the Cordon Bleu. We went all over France to nearly every three-star restaurant in their Citroën, and we would, you know, tootle around together. So they really inspired me. They really helped me to know that there was a big world of food out there beyond what I could see in the wilderness.
Oh, but I remember 21 years ago, I mean, and you knew Julia Child, and you met all the big people. Who were the chefs that were inspirational for you?
Well, you know, Madeline Kamen, really, many young people may not know, but, you know, we had some really tremendous women chefs that that worked very hard, that really honed their craft, and they're not so known these days. Even Julia Child, you know, some younger people don't know of her anymore. But both Julia Child and Madeline Kamen, I was very lucky to know, and to know in a personal way. And I think Madeline was one who really influenced me in terms of working hard and being a perfectionist. And
did you take her classes? Did you go to her school, or did you just work with her?
I don't know if you remember the school that Behringer, School for American Chefs. So yeah. I did that program with her, and she came up to Alaska and stayed with me. And,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, so it was.
She was not the easiest teacher. You know, she was very demanding.
Yeah, she was, and she, you know, softened and, you know.
Do you remember her, Mandy?
I do, yes.
What do you remember about her?
I remember meeting her at our lodge, and she taught me how to make gougères.
Really? You must make very good gougère.
Yeah, so.
Did Julia ever make it up to the lodge?
No, she never got... Well, she did come... I think she came to Alaska maybe really early in the 70s or, you know, one time on a little cruise. But she never came to Alaska during the time I knew her. But one winter, I went back to Cambridge, and I went to school at the BU. There was the master's program there, and I just took one class there. And I called Julia Child on the telephone. We had telephones then, right? I just picked up a payphone.
Did you have her number? Or
no, she was in the phone book.
I know she was. It's like so unbelievable.
I called her up, and I said, "Hi, I'm here from Alaska." And she said, "Well, oh, great. Well, why don't you come to dinner on Thursday?" So that's how I got to know Julia Child. And I went to dinner with her, and we cooked together. We had a nice dinner, and we drank two bottles of Veuve Clicquot champagne.
Just the two of you?
Just the two of us.
That is a great story.
Yeah.
That's a great story. Yeah. Did you know Julia Child? Because you didn't have a TV.
No, I did not ever have the pleasure of meeting her. No.
Yeah, she has her books.
But. Yeah. So what did books mean to you as a chef or a young girl, you know, who liked food? Did you look at the books, or was it really you were so lucky you had the fish jumping out of the river into your kitchen with the chefs there? You're real time.
My mother has an incredible library of cookbooks, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of cookbooks. So even back then, we had quite a lot of books. So it meant a lot for me to look through the cookbooks. But again, you know, we were out foraging for berries and catching fish ourselves, too.
So what were the favorite dishes your mother made when you were little?
Oh, boy. Well, she used to make, when I was quite young, I was a picky eater, so I would like very plain foods, and but I would eat macaroni and cheese with salmon mixed in with it. So that's something that sticks with me from the past. And a chicken noodle soup, she would make very classic classic French soups and stews often.
We have to take a break here, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story from Milan, Italy, and J-Bar, you'll hear it in the background. And today my guests are Kirsten and Mandy Dixon from South Central Alaska. So macaroni and cheese and salmon. You're from South Central, so what kind of fish come out there? What kind of products do you have, especially in the winter?
We have all five species of salmon that run through South Central Alaska during the summer months. King salmon's available in Alaska year-round. We have two species of crab. We have...
They're freshwater crab?
No, they're ocean-based. So they
get flown in.
Yeah, they get flown in. Where Winter Lake Lodge is, it's in the mountains, and there we do some freshwater fishing for salmon and for trout in the summertime. We do have moose meat in our freezer that my son-in-law will give to us, and game meat's not legal to serve to the public in Alaska, so we don't serve moose meat to our guests.
Really? Why is that?
Well, they don't want to create a situation where a lot of people would go out and kill game to sell it and to make money, make profit from it. So they want it to only be for personal use. We have an abundance of other seafood. We have a lodge that's along the ocean at Tatka Bay Lodge. It's in a very beautiful Pacific Ocean estuary that's just teeming with life. We have whales there in the summer that jump out in front
of
the lodge.
Is that where Berlin Cafe is?
Yeah, that's where Mandy's cafe is. Mandy has a little cafe in the small village of Homer, Alaska, which is a very tiny fishing village that's super fun. It's very vibrant. We have the interesting people that live there, very artistic little village. And Mandy's cafe is right in the harbor and right where all the fishermen come in and bring the fish and offload their boats. And then they'll hopefully come into the cafe for a... something to eat.
But. So how many properties do you run now?
My family has two remote wilderness lodges, and we have the cafe. So it's really just three properties.
And how many people do you have working for you?
12, 24. About 40.
40
in the summertime only.
In the summer, yeah.
And then in the winter, only one property is open for the winter, and it's maybe five.
Which one is open?
Winter Lake.
And people actually come in? Mm-hmm.
And it's a checkpoint along the Iditarod Trail.
We have dogs there.
Oh, my gosh. So yes. You see the race go by?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it actually stops at our lodge.
Oh, so over what period of time? Is it days that people come through for the Iditarod? This is...
The race lasts maybe 2 weeks.
Couple
weeks, but they only pass through our lodge for just a couple days. But we have our own dog team and teams, and we go dog mushing. We have about 20 sled dogs. We also do some heli skiing in the winter from February to April. We have heli ski groups staying at our lodge, and we're just very close to an incredibly beautiful mountain range, the Tordrillo Mountains, that are just stunning, and you can really only access them by helicopter. So it's a very adventurous crowd that we get in the winter typically.
What was the hairiest winter, experience you had out there,
Maybe the refugees. One year we had an Iditarod in which air taxis had come to our lake and left many people there to watch the sled dogs pass through the checkpoint. A blizzard came in, and about 40 people were stranded on our lake. And so they weren't guests of ours. We already had our own guests. And we had 40 extra people. And then the blizzard lasted for about 5 days. So we had to set them up in one part of our lodge, literally just sleeping on, sleeping bags on the floor. And we scrambled for blankets. And then we had our own guests through French doors on the other side of the lodge. And we really began to run out of food. We were making, lentil stews and baking bread to feed these extra 40 people, and it was quite a challenge. But we all made it through, and I think they felt like they had a big adventure.
Wow. And so they were, the Iditarod was taking place during that blizzard? Mm-hmm. How did, this isn't very culinary, but how did they, those guys do in the blizzard? Did they just bunker in? Anyone die through it?
No.
Yeah, I don't know if any sled dogs were, I think everybody made it through the blizzard. And, you know, the sled dogs were fine. They could travel through, but, you know, aircraft can't fly when there's no visibility. So it was the people who depended on aircraft that were having the problem.
I see. And so how many other times have you ever run out of food there? And
no.
I don't think so. I mean, I was thinking of, like, we have a freeze-up and a break-up period of the winter. So in the fall, when the lake is freezing, we can't land any airplanes on there. So nobody can get in or out for about 3 weeks or so. Mm-hmm. And then in the springtime, we call a breakup, and it's when the lake ice is breaking up. You can't fly in for 3 weeks. So it's a time that you want to plan, you know, ahead.
Do you ever take time off and not have guests and just downtime?
Yeah, right now we're in Milan.
We only travel away when our lodges are closed. So we are able to come here, which is really incredible. We're very happy to be in Milan. We're super honored to be a part of the James Beard Foundation's culinary program here.
I just have to say, yesterday you were doing a demo on the roof of the pavilion, and, you know, everyone commented, we never had such an enthusiastic response from the public. There had to be 500 people watching. And I guess the shrimp and the
and crab fritter.
Right. Because the crab made it. I don't know. Talk about, you have to get product over there in Milan. We had a hard time getting your product here. But you were the most popular, I think, demonstration we've ever had up on the roof. Did they ask? I wasn't there for any of the questions, and it was primarily Italians. Did you get asked any very strange?
No. If we used Parmesan or Parmesan Reggiano.
Right.
And then what and everybody got excited from. About
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mandy was, so she was just frying away, you know, one at a time. And there were people standing there with their little napkins out. So it was quite something. It was fun.
So what is it like working in the kitchen together? Or do you have separate kitchens? I mean, you have three properties, but do you work together, in the kitchen? And how is that as a mother-daughter? Do you think it's, I'm looking at eyes here going back. What's it like being a mother-daughter team?
I think we really have the opportunity to sort of blend sort of old school ways and more younger thinking. And so sometimes we have big discussions on how something might be, and that's quite fun. We've written two cookbooks together, and our last cookbook won an IACP award, and they've been very rewarding projects for us to do. I mean, it's really just been a family project. We did our own photos. We did our own layout. We did our own text, everything. And the process of developing recipes is something we really enjoy working together on. Mandy's getting more uppity, you know, as she gets a little older, more opinionated, doesn't always listen to her mother. But we have a lot of fun, and I feel, you know, very grateful that I have both my daughters so close in my life and working with us.
What does Carly do?
She is a manager at Tutka Bay Lodge, a lodge manager. She's also a yoga instructor and a massage therapist.
Oh, okay. So
and
she's
a personal trainer.
Okay,
so she's very wellness oriented.
So after you feed them, she can work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, I've met married couples who've worked on books together, and they said never again. I mean, are you going to do another cookbook together, you think?
Yes, I think so.
That is the biggest testament there of a mother-daughter relationship. Yeah. So what is the thing you admire most, Kirsten, about Mandy?
Well, she's a very hard worker. And I think, you know, one of the things that my husband and I have done the best for our children is teaching them the value of hard work. And I think I don't ever worry about my daughters, because I know no matter what they pursue in life, they'll they'll be just fine. And they have been, and they are. Mandy's Little Cafe is super popular. There's always a line out the door, and it's super successful. We just started the Little Cafe as kind of a family project, and now, you know, here we are with a popular little spot. We've done our cookbooks really as a family project, and they've done well for us. So, I think that I admire her talent. Also, you'll see our cuisine tonight, but Mandy's a very talented chef and pastry chef, and I'm certainly proud of that.
Wow. And what do you admire most in your mother? It doesn't have to be culinary. What is it? I mean, there must be something for you to stay and work so closely.
Well, there's lots of things that I admire in her, but I think one thing that sticks out to me is her strong will, she's very strong-minded. She likes to get what she wants in a good way, and she's very persistent on things. She had breast cancer a couple years ago, and she worked through her chemotherapy treatments and still cooked and had a great attitude and is doing great now. And just seeing her go through that and still run her business, really gave me a lot of respect for her in that regard.
Wow, that's quite. Did you go to Anchorage for treatments and have to fly back and forth and still did your work?
Yeah, well, you know, one in every eight women in the United States these days get breast cancer. I mean, it's just amazing statistics. And those of us who are lucky enough to catch it early and have opportunity to have medical care and chemotherapy survive. And those who ignore it perhaps, you know, don't or can't afford care don't survive. Mm-hmm. And that's just a terrifying thing. But but I got through it on the other side. My hair isn't as good as it used. My hair is kind of thin, still in some spots, little bald spots in the back. But I'm doing fine.
So we haven't touched on women in the kitchen. It's 21 years ago, 30 years ago, it was a huge, huge issue. So you have a different, you know, there's different perspectives on this. And so we're going to say goodbye to Mandy. She has to go cook. But what is your personal reflection on the role of women in the kitchen and how far has it come and where does it need to go?
I think, my perspective is slightly different because I'm pretty isolated from the mainstream and I don't live in an urban area. But from my perspective, I think, you know, women have all the opportunities to hone their craft, to learn to be a good chef, to run a kitchen, to own a restaurant, to own a culinary business, and whatever it will be in these days. You know, the years of the, you know, old French male chef screaming at everybody is gone. And I think that good kitchens are respectful ones where everybody's judged on the merit of their talent and skill and their willingness to work hard. So in that regard, I think it's really come a long way in that we can feel more comforted that anyone who really wants to cook can accomplish that.
Yeah, that there's very few glass ceilings anymore. Do you have many women coming to cook up at the lot?
We do. We certainly do. We have women guides. We have women naturalists. We have women managers. And we have women river rafting guides. We have women bear viewing guides, you know, so we have women pilots of, you know, aircraft and helicopters. And so there's certainly opportunity in our world, which is, venture travel is very hardworking life. It's not easy work to have a lodge. It's sort of, maybe it's kind of like an old-fashioned French country inn, in a sense. You know, everything's hard work. It's always, our days are long, but certainly women can participate as much as men.
Has that always been the case up in Alaska? Because I'd imagine if you went there, every human being is valuable, you know, it's not that populated.
Well, I think in the beginning when we started, you know, in the very early 80s, most of our guests were men in kind of, you know, outdoor gear, camo outfits. You know, it was, you know, very, very male dominated. And maybe as the 80s went along, suddenly one day a plane landed and a woman got out in white tennis shoes. And I think really when the cruise ships began to come in up to Alaska, more women came, more families found their way to the backcountry. So it certainly had, you know, was a male-dominated lifestyle for a very, very long time. And only, you know, super adventurous, rare women participated in that life. And I think now the backcountry is more accessible to people. And I think Alaska's in, you know, more of a spotlight these days, certainly with the Arctic, the politics of the Arctic coming along. What will we do with water? What will we do with transportation in the Arctic? And recently, President Obama visited Alaska. Secretary of State John Kerry's been there several times. So I think that Alaska will become a place that perhaps more people will want to come and visit rather than just the outdoor, you know, backcountry adventurer.
What are the big sustainability issues from a food point of view up in Alaska?
Well, you know, it's written into our constitution that we will not farm raise any fin fish, and that means salmon. You know, so Alaska salmon is always wild. And Alaska salmon is organic. It's certified organic. Our water is so cold there, there's few diseases for the fish to have. That happens in warmer water. We have a very good system of sustainability in terms of quotas. Fishermen can't just catch all the fish. It's very highly regulated and observed and monitored. And, I'm very proud of my state to be forward-thinking in that regard.
Well, we're winding down here in the end of our time. What's a vision that you have for your daughters?
Well, I certainly want them to have big lives, and you know, whatever that might be, is fine with me. I want them to know and see the world, but I want them to be able to live in a place that has a certain pristine beauty and clean water and you know, unpolluted views. And so I hope, at least in, you know, our lifetimes, that wild places will still be available to them.
I know everyone is out who's listening out there, as I am. How do we get to your lodge? How do we get in touch?
Lots of direct flights to Anchorage from many urban hubs. Certainly New York, there's also a direct flight. So it's a little ways. I think it's maybe 5.5 hours from New York. That's not so bad.
All?
I think maybe that's just to Seattle, but then from Seattle up. But it's not so bad. And then Anchorage is the largest city in Alaska, and it's the largest city in South Central Alaska. And then we pick you up at the airport from there and take you away. And
how long does it take to get out to your place?
1 hour by airplane.
Wow. Okay. Well, I can't tell you how exciting it's been to talk to you. And you have a gorgeous daughter, and she's so poised, and I'm so talented. I'm going to go eat her food. And we're just thrilled to have you at the expo here in Milan. And you truly did wow everyone on the roof of the pavilion. So really, good luck to you, and the best of everything. And thanks so much for making the time to do the interview today.
Thank you. It's wonderful to see you again.
And we'll say goodbye here. And I just want to do a shout out to Jack Inslee, my producer. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org.
You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.